not fear, the one and only Tucker Carlson. He's here, right now.
Buck up, it's going to get better.
Hello, welcome to Tuckered Out. I'm Troy.
I'm Tyler.
And this is a show where we talk far too much about Tucker Carlson.
Yes, it is.
And today, on this special Wednesday episode, woo!
Yeah.
Because we didn't have time last week. Time is relative, but I feel like it's rude to ask more than 2 hours of your time. We didn't get to the interviews with Sora Bamari or Pedro Gonzalez. So we're going to be covering those today, and these are the two of this kind of cavalcade of quote-unquote intellectuals that Tucker's been interviewing. I think these two are the scariest.
That's not good news.
Especially Pedro Gonzalez, but we'll get there. But first, Tyler, how you doing?
All things considered, it being a Tuesday, doing well.
Yeah, and that's how I normally lead into patrons. We don't have any today. Let's go ahead and get started here. So Sora Bamari is... I have a bit fewer clips than the others from Sora Bamari because a lot of it is biographical, a lot of their interview is, and a lot of it is about his, like, religious journey and how he became a Catholic.
Okay. And became a Catholic? I'll learn.
And I'm not particularly interested in making content out of that. Like, I think religion is stupid, but there are better things to attack Sora Bamari about.
Yeah, I mean, Israel-Palestine conflict, like, if everyone was just an atheist tomorrow, like, it'd be done. You know? Okay, that is... complete minimization. Don't take me out of context on that one. But
yeah, as far as who Sora Bamari is, he's the opinion editor at the New York Post. I've mentioned before, he was the tip of the spear for the anti-drag queen story hour discourse. One thing that does come up in his biographical info, because I don't have any clips of the biography portion, but he talks about how he was born in Iran. And his parents were secular. He says they were, like, performatively Muslim when they went out, but then in the home it wasn't practiced.
Okay.
And then his parents supported the Iranian Revolution. And afterwards, when Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, they immediately regretted having supported that revolution when Iran became an Islamic state. And so they fled the country and came to the United States. They ended up in Utah because Sora Bamari had an uncle there who was already living in the U.S. and they came through, like, family preference, which he points out is quote-unquote chain migration. And Tucker says yes, like, acknowledging he's familiar with the term. What's interesting to me is that so-called chain migration is something Tucker explicitly wants to end. So I found it interesting that he's like, Sora Bamari, I'm happy to be talking to you, but you shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sora Bamari, he mentions that he's been called a dangerous theocrat, and that is a descriptor that I would co-sign. they're going to get into it here, but his idea of conservatism is very centered on religion and the preservation of religious principles in the culture.
Okay.
And I found it interesting that Tucker is so into it, like... This is a bit of a digression, but, I mean, Tucker is a religious guy. He's a Christian. He identifies as an Episcopalian, but always quantifies that by saying that he hates the Episcopalian Church.
Okay.
But I don't think he... I mean, I don't know, but I don't think he's, like, a super devoted guy in his day-to-day life. I remember... I watched a video of him giving a presentation at this, like, religious college, and he was asked... about his views on the inerrancy of Scripture, so the inability of Scripture to be in error. And he really hedged on his answer. He talked around it. He was, I mean, I believe that the Scripture is correct, kind of implying that he thinks, like, it's spiritually true, if not historically true.
Okay. Yeah. So, like, most Christians,
yeah.
I think.
Not the ones I grew up with, but I don't know if that's most or just... I grew up thinking the Earth was 6,000 years old, at most, so...
Ooh.
my favorite is the people who are like, yeah, God put the bones there and made them look old to trick us. Why?
Um, So that we would believe in him, question mark.
But yeah, I mean, it can't be too easy to be a Christian. That's the point. I want some cognitive dissonance, damn it. So, yeah, speaking of cognitive dissonance, let's listen to Soar Bamari speak. And like with the others here, I have just a brief clip that provides the spirit of the general conversation they're going to have.
Who are the good guys in this? Who are the people you think are thinking clearly right now about where the country is, what we need to do to protect its citizens?
Well, I mean, without being too cheesy, one of them is sitting across from me right now.
Aww. Yeah, so then Soar Bamari recently released a book. I didn't write down the title, but it was something like, I think they're going to say it in here, but the subtitle was Living in an Age of Chaos. So Tucker is going to ask him here what an age of chaos means.
I mean, they just had Jordan Peterson on, right? They could ask him.
The age of the feminine.
Your book, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos.
That's the title.
Let's start with the last word, chaos. You describe this as an age of chaos. What does that mean?
Well, that what I just described is we live, this is why as you may know, I'm often at war with the rest of the conservative movement, where I think we're living in an age that makes it very difficult for people like me, who is a father and a man of faith, and my children to be formed to live ordinary, decent, virtuous lives. We're actually severely disciplined in other ways, like the COVID regime or on questions of sex and gender, what we're allowed to say, critical race. So it's not that we're not disciplined, but the discipline orders us in some ways toward disorder. So it's very perverse. And
so is it possible we've replaced one set of disciplines with another?
Yeah. I mean, and that's in many ways the argument of the book, that there's no neutrality. A society has to stand for something. Some God, some authority will always be enshrined in the public square. The only question is which.
Yeah, so...
Citation needed on that one?
Yeah, I take issue a little bit with the assertion right away, but it goes to this thing that Tucker talks about, too, that humans have an innate religious impulse where, like, you're always searching out a religious meaning.
Yeah. No. I remember being 11 years old and finding out that God wasn't fact. Like, some people just believed in that. And I'm like, oh, well, forget that. I don't care.
Yeah, and like
that was 11.
Like the fact that that's something you had to realize is proof that the Christianity is not under assault. These people are.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's petty, but like severe COVID discipline.
Yes.
Wear a mask is not severe discipline, you twit.
Yeah. I think what he talks about is people being... I think what he means by severe discipline is people being mean to him on Twitter.
Oh, no. People were being mean to me on Twitter.
But yeah, they're going to go ahead and expound on this point a little bit.
So you can't have a society in which you say, well, I believe there are two sexes, which is what Genesis and genetics tell us, but someone else might believe, you know, there's 135 genders.
So it took us about two sentences to get into transphobia this time.
Those two, sure. One or the other, will predominate. And what we're seeing now is, as a lot of the movement that you and I share, the conservative movement, relinquished being willing to not only say what orthodoxy is, but also enforcing it in the public square. And now a different orthodoxy is being coerced.
So you're saying the libertarian ideal is not workable. It's a lie. You can't actually kind of sit there. You're getting an orthodoxy, whether yes, you like it or not. So it's not enough to say, you know, you believe what you believe, I believe what I believe. No, one of our beliefs is going to be forced on the other guy.
I don't think Tucker realizes how fucked up of a statement that is.
Yeah.
But the idea that it's impossible to just accept that other people believe different things is a bad way to go about your life.
Yeah. Also, there's an entire half of the country that is all for people believing different things.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think So Sohrab Ahmari's like main ideological project is divorcing conservatism from libertarianism.
Okay.
Because
I feel like that makes sense, because I feel like every Republican libertarian isn't actually a libertarian.
Yeah. Yeah. Sohrab Ahmari's main project is like rectifying that dissonance where like no, the government shouldn't just say live and let live. You should live a certain way.
At least they're honest about it.
I mean, the past 2 years have utterly demolished the idea of a neutral public square. Just, there's no way. Past few decades, really, but especially the past few years, it's just become so stark that one orthodoxy is now seeking to lord it over the rest of us and happens to be have a very distorted anthropology of account of who human beings are, what makes them happy, what's the difference between men and women. It's in all these areas. It's extremely perverse, but it's winning.
Yay, more transphobia. Cool.
Get a second example.
Yeah.
This is kind of a springboard. They get into some ideas of individual liberty, which, as you might guess from the way the conversation has gone so far, Sohrab Ahmari has some thoughts about.
It is winning. And it's not even winning. It's sort of like rushing right over the ramparts. Yeah. There are no defenses, yeah. Right? No one's putting up a fight. So let me ask you about that. You said you have found yourself at odds with people with whom you're allied on other issues, fellow conservatives, on this issue of how many sexes there are and of the so-called trans movement. Why do you think so many conservatives who share your values, basically, mm-hmm. I would say, have decided they're going to sit this fight out?
I think they've done it out of an overemphasis on individual autonomy as the highest good of human life. Individual autonomy is very important in some respects, but it's not the only good. And in some cases, we see how the loss of barriers against individual autonomy actually makes us less free. So an obvious example is the gender stuff, right? The idea that society regulated what the sexes, the difference between the sexes, and told people what the difference between men and women were. They were complementary, equal in dignity, but different, et cetera, has been lost. And we lost it in the name of liberation, right? Like, now we get to define who we are. Even if my body disagrees with me, I can will myself into defining my own gender. In practice, that requires you to enforce me to enforce on you. You have to recognize me as something that you interiorly know that's not true. So we have these kind of pronoun dictatorship and so on and so forth. So what looked like a promise of liberation, define yourself, actually in practice worked out as a kind of oppression.
So as you said of your parents, you could support the revolution, but instantly come to regret it once it wins.
Right, when it's gone. When it's gone.
Okay, things someone who's never lived in a dictatorship would say, pronoun dictatorship.
Yeah, fuck every word of that business.
Yeah, yeah.
We still don't have a second example, by the way. But the idea that, the dismantling of barriers to individual autonomy has made us less free because, B, I have to acknowledge other people's preferred identity.
Yeah.
That's an infringement on my freedoms to have to recognize you as a person. Like, that's deeply...
completely backwards, yeah.
He uses so much extra language, which is something all these people do when they're saying terrifying things.
Yeah, like, it's hard to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Just listening to it for the first time.
What he just said is that pushing for more freedoms makes us less free because it impinges on my freedom to disrespect you.
Yeah, pretty much.
So fucked up. And then Tucker, throughout a lot of this conversation, keeps trying to draw parallels between what's happening in the United States now to the Iranian Revolution.
Okay.
And I don't think it's necessarily responsible to draw parallels because they're such radically different environments and situations.
Yeah.
But I will say that one of the characteristics of the Iranian Revolution was that, like, kind of liberal pro-democracy people, like Sohrab Ahmari's parents, allied themselves with religious zealots, because both were opposed to the ruling regime. It's the pro-democracy people wanted more democracy, and the zealots wanted an Islamic state. And they became kind of like uncomfortable bedfellows in pushing for the revolution. At the end of that, obviously, the Ayatollah came into power and Iran became an Islamic state, and people like Sobhan Mari's parents fled the country.
Yeah.
Now, I point this out because Sobhan Mari is going to say some things that in spirit it sounds like we're going to agree with. And I think it's important to keep in mind he can never be an ally.
Yeah. I get that from a lot of the guests on here. Like, they talk about, like, Tucker always likes to talk about how much he hates the elites. It's just like we're talking about different elites and we have different ideas about what to do about it. So, yeah, I feel like that happens a lot.
Or, you know, I mean, it's a theme that you talk a lot about on your shows, overweening corporate power, again, sold as market liberty, market individualism, in practice ends up squeezing out other things. So the loss of the American Sabbath is something I talk about in the book. The fact that even before there was a republic in the colonies, and not just in Puritan New England, we had a kind of Sabbath tradition where there was one day you set aside for not competing, for not being inquisitive, for being at peace with your neighbor. And it took a long time for those traditions to be eroded over time, and it was kind of chamber of commerce style libertarianism that chipped away at them in the name of autonomy again. Do what you want. Shop. Work. However much you want on Sunday. In practice, it just means we're more harried. Parents, especially working class parents, don't have time to spend with their kids. It's the liberty of corporations. It's not the liberty of the family. And so we wonder, why are kids confused? Why don't we form families? Why are birth rates declining? There's no space for it.
Yeah, so in principle, like, people should have more time off work.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm getting serious deja vu. Have we talked about this before?
In the Lost episode, there were a couple of these clips.
Oh, it was that recent. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
So most of this is new to you. There are a couple of these that you've heard before on when we were lost to oblivion.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. that answers that. Okay.
Yeah, you're not crazy.
Yeah, like a Sabbath would be great, but I don't think that he wants a Sabbath for like secular people.
Right, yeah. It's explicitly tied to religious orthodoxy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Tucker here is going to talk about his experience with the Sabbath.
So in practical terms, the debate over the Sabbath really came down to, can you buy beer on Sundays?
Yeah.
And I think for most people, that's, you know, if I want a beer on Sunday, it's kind of like my right to have a beer on Sunday.
Sure.
I never heard a single, and in fact, I lived at one point and worked at a newspaper in the state of Arkansas where this was a real debate because there were still blue laws, so-called blue laws on the books. I don't recall a single person ever pointing out that there was a bigger idea behind this. It wasn't just a punitive measure designed to keep you from drinking on Sunday. Mm-hmm. It was an effort to recognize that we should take a break from the harried nature of life to reconnect with our families and neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Why did no one say that, I wonder?
I don't know. We don't frame things in, including conservatives, we don't frame things in moral terms because we think that would be an imposition on the other person, if you bring up, if you bring up Exodus,
yeah.
But it's very sad because I mean, as it was Oliver Wendell Holmes, the jurist who was not a great sort of super religious person, said, "Whoever invented the Sabbath is a friend of the working man." Those small and pop mom and pop shops in Arkansas are not the ones who would agitate for getting rid of blue laws. It was always kind of the big box retail stores. Because the mom and pop shops would have trouble staffing on Sundays anyway. And no one talked about the idea of interior liberty.
Yes. Okay.
So I've worked at a store that, like, it didn't sell beer. Like, later in the day on Sunday, they would sell beer, but not on Sunday morning.
Yeah, I remember, because I worked in a different store that had a similar thing, and I was like, really? That's still a law? That's a thing?
Yeah, I don't have a point. Just, I remember one time, though, there was this dude who, he came in, and he, like, he was about to turn 21. It was like 11:50 when he came in. And he walked in and stood in the store until it became midnight and he was old enough to buy alcohol. But then his birthday was on a Sunday, so like, and because it was then 12 a.m. Sunday morning, I couldn't sell it to him. He was furious.
That would be so disappointing.
I know, right? Yeah, so let's see here. Then, Sora Bamari, I don't remember exactly what this clip is about, but it's labeled Surviving Progress.
I mean, I'm framed as a theocrat and a reactionary sometimes in the public square, but as you say, this is, in some ways, I see the failings of both the establishment and the establishment right. Both of them have pursued this project of liberation. On the right, liberation for the boardroom, for the CEO. On the left, liberation in the bedroom, you know, whatever you want to do, whoever you want to define yourself as. And working in tandem, they've deregulated many realms of life in ways that in practice make us less free, less happy, less fully human.
You have a deep skepticism of liberation movements, I've noticed.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, maybe because in my family, we paid the price for one of them. No, I mean, my friend Patrick Deneen says it's a line that's etched in my mind that one of the mankind's greatest tasks for the 21st century is how to survive progress.
Okay. That was where I was going to make the point about the Iranian Revolution.
Okay. So he just is casually opposed to liberation, which I don't like. I don't like that at all.
Yeah, it just, like, he's very, like, affable and polite and kind of difficult to pay attention to, like you said. But, like, this is scary shit.
Like, if you're just listening to him talk and you don't hear what he's saying, he sounds like a really nice, agreeable person.
Yeah, this is stuff that, like, since the Constitution, we've been aware that we need to be wary of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So at this point, Sora Bamari is going to explain why it's important, or why we need to restore the idea that the body is important. And you'll never guess what his example is.
And then I think we have to restore the idea that that your body is not just this fleshly apparatus in which your mind stuff is housed, mind or soul. This is a very widespread movement today. You see it in transhumanism and Silicon Valley types seeking to sort of store their minds and think of their selves as purely mind. But it's all...
That was a fake out. Transhumanism is his example.
I don't think transhumanism is like a huge thing.
Yeah, I think
I could be wrong.
I think he's just talking about like the Neuralink thing with Elon Musk.
Okay. Could we just not talk about Elon Musk for ever?
Ever would be preferable. But yeah, I mean, if there were a big push to digitize the human consciousness, that'd be worth having some conversations about the implications of.
Yeah, like, as far as I know, there's no conceivable way to do that right now, so it's yeah. not like a yeah. huge
I
movement.
Mean, we're a ways away. I don't think you have to worry, Sorab.
Yeah.
But it's also in the transgender ideology, the idea that that I have an interior gender that's at odds with the body that I receive from nature. It's a kind of Gnosticism, which was...
Yes, I was about to say. I've heard this before.
It was these movements, you know, in late antiquity after Christianity, after the advent of Christianity, first 200-300 years, that treated the body as this evil, awful thing. And the person was really this sort of divine spark that sought to escape from the bodily and from the embodied. Historic Christianity always rejected that. It always treated the human body as the human person as a dynamic union of soul and body. So Jesus is fully God and fully man, and he redeems humankind in embodied form. His mother is assumed into have an embodied form so that we're not just spirit stuff. We're also the body means something.
Okay, and like, I'm cool with you believing that. but you can't just like blanket say everyone believes this.
Yeah.
And it's okay to make rules based on my belief about how spirits work.
Yeah, it just like, and he's working off the presumption that my belief is the true one, and that's why this is hypocritical.
Yeah, and like they're calling like other, they're calling science religious because they don't believe in it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't believe in their religion, so obviously it's just a religion. Maybe
this guy in particular resonates with me because like I've made some allusions to like I grew up in a very religious situation, and I went through like a good deal of what I would call like religious trauma in dealing with that. Like it was a big feature of my formation as a person. Like I gave a sermon when I was 14 at my church. Like and not a single one of the people I met during that time I would want running the government.
Yeah.
At this point, Sora Bamari wants to get into some current events. They're going to talk about masks.
In the immediate sense, it means we have to get rid of these kind of social distancing forever measures, because it's very inhuman. The idea of kids forever just learning from screens, college becoming primarily a screen-based experience, currency becoming ever more abstract with Bitcoin, so therefore there's no attachments to political community and taking care of others attached to them. All of these movements seek to abstract us away from each other. I think it's very, very dangerous. Masks, in a way. I get so furious when people say, well, we conquered the coronavirus, but the flu season is pretty dangerous. Why don't we mask forever? Abstract each other. Abstract ourselves from each other. I mean, I think...
What are the dangers of that? I mean, it's just public health.
I mean, I think we're
I agree with you, Fiona.
No, I know.
I would just like to hear someone explain it more eloquently than I'm capable of. But I know that you can.
I don't know if I think that's because I watch your show and I know you rage against this stuff as much as anyone. But we are embodied beings, so that there is no Tucker for me beyond the Tucker that I see in a person, in a face.
Right.
And that makes you fully human for me.
Okay, so...
So people with masks are not fully human, is his argument.
Like... I think if what he was saying there were true about the way humans operate, then texting wouldn't be a thing.
True.
I don't know how to put it, but when I see, because I live in Manhattan and it's getting a little bit better, but still you see just it's overwhelming these masked faces. It's very alienating. It's got to be something inhuman about it. And I know that there are some cultures where they do that, but that's not the West. The West has always honored the human form.
Well, the cultures in which that's prevalent, Islamic culture would be the first that comes to mind, have it precisely because it cuts people off from one another.
Right.
So he talks a bit about how... mandatory veiling is a means of cutting a woman off from people other than her immediate family. Mm-hmm. And Sora Bamari is like, yes, and that's fine for those cultures, but that's not what the West has done traditionally. And then he refers to masks as a medical hijab.
He's also just mischaracterizing how people use masks. Like, people aren't generally wearing masks in their homes with their families.
Yeah.
They're wearing it out in public around strangers.
Yeah, walking on a crowded street is not like a spiritual experience for me I like deeply know every face I see. Like,
yeah.
At this point, though, Tucker gets kind of weird.
It's all the same people who are for this stuff. And I probably shouldn't say this, I'm just going to say it. I mean, I have nothing against prophylactics or anything like that, but there was a certain sort of person in the 80s who got so thrilled by the idea that no one would ever have sex again without a condom. And it wasn't really about stopping the transmission of AIDS, which obviously I'm for, and I'm, you know, not arguing against condoms, but there was a kind of person who just like loved the idea of reducing physical contact between people with latex. It's just true. I remember it really well. I lived here then.
What does he remember?
Yeah.
Who is maniacally like, no one will ever touch their naughty bits again.
Admittedly, I was not alive in the 80s, but I strongly doubt that there were people who were like, oh, thank God we have an excuse not to have sex anymore.
Yeah, I've read a fair bit of history, and I've never run across like the problem of condom zealots.
Yeah, yeah, nobody fucking likes condoms. Like,
I guarantee Tucker doesn't use a condom.
Like, no fucking way.
He would throw such a hissy fit about how you were trying to cancel his dick.
He'd test HIV positive and still.
It would definitely be cancel culture.
You're trying to cancel my dick.
I thought, man, I mean, obviously they're very creepy people with totally screwed up and distorted personal lives. But like, it's the exact same people who are like, it's not a big deal to wear a mask or to never shake a hand again or never to touch people love.
Never
like,
so many of my neighbors and people I live with were in that category of weirdo.
And I want to say during that, Tucker definitely thought he was making a joke during the whole condom riff, and Sorbo Mari, his face was stone cold. He did not laugh once. Yeah, so then here, Sorbo Mari, he's upset that people say he's a dangerous theocrat, and he's going to explain why that's a problem by being a dangerous theocrat.
You said dangerous theocrat. I mean, we're going to get dangerous theocrats at some point, aren't we? I mean, how long can you have a society with no meaning at the center of it? Where, like, your Amazon account is the sum total of the meaning of your life? Like, that's not sustainable.
I think we have the dangerous theocrats. They're already here. Right?
Good point!
We have a clerisy that you have to you have to kiss their rings and so forth. So, again, the idea that authority will come one way or another. The question is, it a reasonable authority? Is there as an authority that stands on the wisdom, accumulated wisdom of generations, of revelation? Or is it, you know, a public health bureaucrat,
right,
and a gender ideologue?
No, that's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. No, you're getting a theocracy.
Yeah.
And if you thought the crucifixion was stupid, wait till you see transgender politics. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. People say, well, that's unlikely. Rose from the dead? Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. That's supernatural for sure.
Yeah.
Not quite as crazy as the idea you can will yourself into another gender, though, is it?
Nope.
That's also not what being transgender is.
So I'm stuck on the... this is something I have come across with religious people a lot. It's like, they have this one central thing that they connect to and then assume that everyone else has to think about things the exact same way. So, like, as an atheist, I've had people, I've said to people that I'm an atheist, and they're like, how do you live your life without any meaning? It's like, I have meaning, it just isn't a central masculine authority like it is for you, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't really think that most people do that. Like, I shouldn't attribute things to other people, but like, meaning isn't added to my life if a god created me, you know? Like, I still have to live my life and do things that are enjoyable to me to find meaning, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. The hard part with talking about these kinds of things is just that people are talking through different frames of mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which we've been talking about a lot recently.
Yeah, I just, like, not having a meaning handed down to you, for you, seems scary if you've always lived that way, but it's really not that bad.
Yeah, yeah. Or, like, I don't need humanity to matter on a universal scale, if that makes sense. Like, some people are like, well, if God didn't create the universe, then how do you find any meaning in your life? It's like, well, like, I create meaning in my life without, like, you know?
Yeah,
like, you create your own meaning. You don't have to
Yeah, like, okay, your conception is God created an entire universe. Do you know how fucking big the universe is?
Yeah.
Like, we have to cast ourselves as the protagonists in the universe? Like,
yeah.
It's ridiculous.
If you've ever done, like, the universe to scale thing where you scroll out to find out how big things are, it's like, if God made an entire universe for us, he wasted, like, 90% of his fucking time. 99% of his time.
Yeah, like, things matter in so much as the lived experiences of people who are alive right now. That's,
yeah. Yeah. And that's not something that they're ever going to believe. So it, even though it's so liberate, oh, that makes sense. He hates liberation. Okay. we solved it.
Yeah, so then here he's going to talk about what motivated him to write his book.
You've referred a couple of times to market forces acting against human interests, Christian interests, interests of the family, the basic interests that like make it worth being alive. Conservatives have sold the idea that the market economy is the key to human liberation, as you pointed out. So like, can you have a conservative, small C conservative society, a happy family-based society that allows the market sort of untrammeled influence over everything?
So I'm not a socialist. I don't want public ownership of this enterprise.
Well, I agree.
But there comes a point when you see that corporate interests run counter to what's good for the family. I'll give you a typical example, and they'll say, he's a moralist. But one of the things that prompted me to write this book was my son was one at the time, and I'm riding the New York subway, and there are these ads for the dating company OkCupid, and they have DTF, that the acronym DTF, down to F word. And I just wondered, what if my son were to ask me, Baba, what's DTF mean? And they have a kind of other messages about drug abuse, but in a kind of ha-ha-ha casual way, polyamory. And I just thought, why am I having to navigate a society that's this degraded as a father? I mean, a society should be ordered to the good of the family. This is a very obvious point to me.
Why do I have to acknowledge that other humans exist and have sex with each other to my kid?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Like, all of this is predicated on, like, there's one correct way to be a family.
Yeah.
Like, I just disagree. Like,
yeah, there's nothing wrong with letting your kid know that sex is a thing.
Yeah. But that an advertisement on the subway is what motivated him to write this book. It's crazy to me.
Sure, whatever you say.
Yeah. It's the lamest supervillain origin story. And then Tucker was like, who runs OkCupid? Why wouldn't that person be infamous? And then I looked into it a bit. OkCupid is owned by another company that's owned by another company. It's like, it
sounds about right.
There's not a person to be infamous. But then this is the last clip I have of Sora Bamari. He's going to bring some of this into real world focus. He's going to talk about a story that the New York Post tried to run that was censored. And listeners of our show, that some of this will be familiar to you.
Conservatives have been so alert to the possibility of public tyranny, meaning from the government, that they've lost sight of the fact that there's also private tyranny. And a clear example is what we went through with the New York Post, right? In October, New York Post, where I work, we were censored by these private actors against whom we had no defense. Now, and we were exercising the most noble function of journalism in that case, right? A potential graft involving a would-be leader of the free world, his son is getting paid $50,000 a month by a shady Ukrainian energy company called Burisma, and then arranging meetings between executives from that company and his father, who at the time was the second most powerful man in the world and was the Obama administration's point man on Ukraine. There's nothing more clear. I mean, and the emails we had uncovered remain undisputed. We were very transparent about how we got hold of the emails. And nevertheless, you had big tech censoring us. Now, a certain type of conservative would say, well, you know, it's a private actor doing it, and that's the end of discussion. The fact that you were censored by Twitter or Facebook means that there's nothing more to be said about the issue. But a realist would say, if a noble endeavor like journalism really matters, these days it matters on these privately owned platforms. Yeah, I could go out into the middle of, you know, Fifth Avenue with a drum and say, Hunter Biden is corrupt, dang, 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 and people would think I'm a nutter.
Yes, you would be, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, he's talking about the Hunter Biden laptop story.
Yeah.
Which
is still a thing, apparently.
Which I disagree with Sarbamari on most things, but I don't think he's an idiot. He's aware that that story was bullshit.
Yeah, and I would be very interested to know what he thinks of the Trump family, because if he is so up in arms about Hunter Biden's problems,
yeah.
Like...
Trump, you know, Donald Trump, the paragon of traditional family values.
Yeah!
God, like, it... And this is a really good... This conversation was really good exemplar to me of, like... Because I do want to highlight, there seems to be this thing happening among, like, movement conservatism, where they're becoming increasingly hostile to unregulated free market capitalism. Hostile might be too strong a word, but they aren't opposed to using the government to influence or to curb corporate power when it comes to, like, quote unquote, precluding them from living these lives they want,
which right.
means having to, like, see advertisements that include people they don't like.
or words they don't like.
But it, in this vacuum of ideology, then, what replaces the... Okay, Tucker talks about people having a religious impulse. You're always going to be seeking a religion, right?
Yeah.
In the absence of a religious fervor for free market capitalism, what you get is religious fervor.
Yeah.
So that brings us to Pedro Gonzalez. Now, I'd never heard of Pedro Gonzalez prior to his appearance in Tucker Carlson's show. And I don't think he's been around a very long time. He's 30. He's a writer at American Greatness and also writes for a magazine called Chronicles. But he... I found this conversation tremendously interesting. And of these guys who we've talked about, you know, Charlie Kirk, Glenn Elmers, Pedro Gonzalez is the one who I think has the most capacity to eventually make my life worse.
Ooh.
I will say this, he is a very, very smart guy. He doesn't have a degree. He has attended some, like, small college, but he hasn't graduated. He's mostly, like, he's done a lot of kind of self-education. I can tell he's read fucking everything. He's got primary sources out the ass. He's a smart dude. And I also... believe him to be a fascist.
Oh boy.
We'll get into a bit more of why I think that. I've read most of the columns he's written for American Greatness over the past 2 weeks. I don't like this guy very much. But here's the spirit of this conversation.
I guess intersectional is the idea that we're all united in worshipping Tim Cook or something.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
What?
Yeah, so with that out
Does
of the...
Does anybody worship Tim Cook? Like,
I don't think Tim Cook worships Tim Cook.
Is there anybody who's even mildly interested in Tim Cook?
Is he talking about Tim Apple? Still the funniest fucking thing that happened in those 4 years. but here's how Tucker introduces this conversation with Mr. Gonzalez.
Welcome to Tucker Carlson Today. American politics is changing very, very quickly. Some of those changes are highly distressing, but the upside is people are thinking more freely than they ever have, possibly. And so we like to keep track of who's thinking the most interesting things. And in that category, our next guest, a man called Pedro Gonzalez, is near the top. He's a senior writer at American Greatness. He's a columnist for Chronicles Magazine. He joins us today to describe his intellectual journey and where he thinks things stand, including the Republican Party. Pedro Gonzalez, really glad to see you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Tucker.
So you are 30 years old.
Yes.
You are not trained as a professional intellectual,
no,
but that is what you've become. And I think one of the more interesting people writing and talking about what we're seeing that we have. So to start off, to sort of root this conversation in you, describe how you got to where you are now. Where are you from? When did you start thinking the things that you currently think? How are you?
Okay, so they talk a lot about Page's background and, quote unquote, his intellectual journey. He talks about how in the run-up to the 2016 election, he was like a Bernie bro.
And now he's a fascist?
And he talks about how he became ostracized from his other liberal friends when he started pointing out similarities between the Bernie Sanders and the Trump campaigns, which were all superficial.
Yeah.
And then he talks about how part of his progress to becoming a conservative was in realizing that his liberal friends were meaner when he disagreed with them. If he said things like, hey, maybe feminism isn't good, or maybe transgenderism isn't good, then they would get upset, as opposed to his conservative friends, who, when he said things they disagreed with, they would just kind of shrug it off and maybe recommend something he could read. And he'd go, oh, these guys seem a lot more grounded.
Uh-huh.
I think that reasonable people could be upset when you suggest diminishing the value of the human beings.
Yeah.
An
entire gender, perhaps, or an entire...
Yeah, they talk for a while about his background. I didn't cut any of that, but I do have a clip here where Tucker at the beginning kind of summarizes what they talked about up to this point.
So I enrolled as an English major. And
where?
Palomar College in San Diego.
Yep.
And this was part of my whole, like, the scales falling from the eyes was... I realized that I couldn't even... That was the one thing I've always liked doing in life, was as a kind of a hobby, reading and writing. And I realized that actually studying English literature in college kills your love of English literature, if you're not on board with the program. So we couldn't read Mark Twain unless we talked about the racism and the sexism and the colonialism in Mark Twain. And I just ended up getting into a lot of arguments with my professor, with my peers and stuff, and... This story probably sounds familiar to a lot of people, but that was actually part of my...
I don't think it sounds familiar to anybody.
You sure?
Your parents were immigrants from Mexico. They did not work in high-wage jobs.
Right.
You went to public high school. You tried to get in the military. You moved furniture. You worked as a security guard, but somehow you developed this intense love of literature, of reading.
Yeah.
And then you went to Palomar College, not a place in Washington that's considered prestigious.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no, it's not a familiar path, actually.
Yeah, I guess I don't think of it. This is actually probably the first time I've ever talked about myself. I actually don't like talking about myself.
Good.
Right, yeah.
I hope we can force you just for a few more minutes here.
Yeah.
Because because it is so different. And the background of people who comment on politics, including me, on both sides, is numbingly familiar.
Yeah.
It's the same schools. It's the same summer jobs.
Yeah.
And you depart from that template pretty dramatically.
Growing up poor is not familiar to Americans.
Yeah, Tucker's showing his cards a little bit there. Like, I've never met anybody with your background like yours.
Wow, that is just, like, out of touch is an understatement.
Yeah, that exchange says a lot about Tucker.
Yes, it does. Holy crap. I can't believe he said that. I can't believe he said that.
But yeah, I think a lot of Tucker's fascination with Pedro Gonzalez is like, I met this Mexican guy, and he's a poor, and he's smart. And he says things I agree with. It's crazy. Tucker even says at the end of this conversation, like, he's like, I think that you're going to be a big deal for many years going forward, and I wanted to get it on tape here at the start of your career. Like, Tucker thinks he's discovered somebody in this guy.
And then quick interjection, I got into disagreements with some of my literature professors, but I have a feeling that Tucker wouldn't care because the disagreements that I got into were not about pushing up against the quote-unquote liberal elite or whatever.
Yeah,
because I had a conservative teacher who, like, was anti-union. I'm like, hey, actually, unions are good. And then, you know.
And I literally only had one college professor who ever expressed a political opinion. And what it was, he said, I don't think socialism is necessarily good. So that was all.
So you were screaming in your head for the rest of that, I bet.
And then here, Pedro Gonzalez is almost done talking about himself, but he reveals a key element of his personality here that I think is important.
I think I'm just kind of curious by nature and really stubborn. So if you tell me not to say something or not to think something, I'm going to do it even harder. And I still do that now. Like, if people tell me that I can't have this opinion because it's not a truly conservative opinion, I will double down. But I will do it in a way that I think is compelling and convincing. And that was what fueled initially my transition from being, let's say, left-leaning to being something like a neoconservative.
Okay, so he reveals there that basically he has oppositional defiance disorder.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, why would I trust anything this guy says if he's just wants to be a contrarian?
Yeah, I think that's really important to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And that probably did. I mean, Tucker's the same way, so he's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But, yeah, so he talked about there becoming a neoconservative. He's going to talk about that a little bit more here.
A neoconservative. So someone who kind of still had socially, what's the saying, fiscally conservative and socially liberal. So I became that.
Yes.
And then I abandoned that, too. And now I am whatever I am.
But why did you abandon? So, So you went from being a Bernie guy, seeing that actually there was something similar in Trump's message, but then you went to kind of the very center of elite American politics, which is socially liberal, fiscally conservative. Yeah. Why did you abandon that?
Because it's also the contradictions are just untenable in my view. Like you can't have a socially liberal society and a fiscally conservative society at the same time. I think that those two things don't work. And also, I don't consider myself in any sense ideologically aligned to something like fiscal conservatism. I don't even know what that means in the context of American conservatism. It doesn't make sense. And this is one of the things that that I've kind of made my hobby horse is beating this issue. When Republicans, Republican lawmakers, and conservative think tanks talk about fiscal conservatism, it's usually a lie. They don't believe it. I'll give an example here. Maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves.
But no, not at all.
I'll give an example.
Okay, so before he gives an example, I want to say I agree with the statement that socially liberal, fiscally conservative is an inherent contradiction because fiscal conservatism necessitates a small social safety net, which is always going to disadvantage the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
But that's not the contradiction that Pedro Gonzalez sees in it.
Okay.
Conservative think tanks are in the business of telling people bootstraps, not bailouts.
Right.
But that's not true. If you look at who's donating to what, like the Texas Public Policy Foundation, so much of what they do is underwritten by the gas and oil industry. So at the same time that institutions like that are saying, and independent of how you feel about the issue, at the same time they're saying stimulus checks are bootstraps, or like this policy, or sorry, stimulus checks are bailouts, which are bad, or this policy, like the minimum wage or something, that's a bailout, that's bad. At the same time they're saying that, their work is being underwritten by an industry that is subsidized by taxpayer dollars. The gas and oil industry received a $10 billion subsidy during the pandemic at the same time that organizations like TPPF or the Heritage Foundation were saying, we can't help American people because that's a bailout. And the American people get bootstraps. But our donors get bailouts.
Yeah.
And that's why I completely abandoned the whole fiscal, because it's a lie anyways. And I'm not I'm all for cutting taxes on working people and like the middle class.
Yes.
But that's not actually what happens when these conservative wonks and Republican lawmakers talk about this stuff. They're talking about helping the people who are, in fact, putting a boot on their constituents' necks.
So, again, generally agree.
Yeah.
At this,
I have a feeling we'll have different opinions about the solution to these problems.
Hell yeah. but yeah, it on its face, everything you said there, I agree with. Like I didn't cut a clip of it, but at one point he says like all these think tank institutions, like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, he would like to see disappear. Which I don't know how Tucker felt about that, being a former Cato fellow, but. But then Tucker asks him to clarify here the distinction he's talking about, and this is where things start to go south.
You said that you can't have fiscal conservatism with social liberalism. What does that mean?
People will demand, I think social liberalism, we should call it what it is, it's libertinism. And I think that when you have a libertine society, that kind of lifestyle will demand basically help from the state. So, like, transgender rights is connected to subsidizing gender affirmation therapy. Like, this should be paid for by the federal government. Me being castrated and having my male genitalia reconstructed into female genitalia, I shouldn't have to pay for that. And that, you see where I'm going with
this?
I
do.
Every single one.
Yep. Wow, they never miss. They never miss on the transphobia.
But yeah, what he said there, the reason why socially liberal, fiscally conservative is a contradiction is because if you take a socially liberal approach, then people will start asking for things like healthcare from the government.
Which is bad, question mark?
And he's getting back kind of in like the Sora Bamari argument that like, why should my tax dollars have to subsidize your gender affirmation surgery? Like, to which I would say, why the fuck not?
Yeah, like, it's just, you don't just get to pick and choose what your tax dollars go to. Like,
yeah.
Like if you throw a potluck, you can't just be like, I'm not having a potluck if there's going to be carrots there. Like, like, you know?
Yeah,
like you eat the parts of the potluck that you like, and you utilize the tax services that you want. And if you don't want to use the other things, then fuck off.
Imagine the bureaucracy if you could pick and choose what your tax dollars went to.
Oh my god.
I mean, I would uncheck every fucking defense spending box, but
oh yeah, yeah.
And to be fair, I think so would Pedro Gonzalez. I don't have all of the clips where he talks about this, but he's opposed to the defense budget. However, in one of his American Great... or a bloated defense budget, I should say. But in one of his American Greatness columns, he clarifies that conservatives should be wary when Republicans demand a large defense budget because the Department of Defense views white supremacists as a potential terror threat. And so you're funding your own oppression if you agree to give the Department of Defense more money.
What?
Yeah. Like
the military is used to oppress us?
Yeah. That wasn't a totally fair characterization of his argument. More in line with what he said is, if you're a white conservative man, the federal government views you as a potential threat. And you should keep that in mind when you support Republicans who want a larger defense budget.
Okay. Citation needed on they see you as a threat.
Yeah, and he's just talking about, like, basically Biden's Defense Department and Justice Department acknowledging that white supremacists are dangerous.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
And then at this point, he's gonna get into another reason you can't have a socially liberal, fiscally conservative society. It's because all them damn immigrants are gonna want to come over.
Yeah, it becomes or like socially liberal, like, oh, let's open the borders, immigration. And I, for the record, I think that the problem is mostly with the United States rather than the immigrants, and here's why. So we open the borders, we invite people here, and those people who are not used to living in the United States, where we still talk about limited government, although I don't think that really exists anymore, well, these people come from countries where the state is much larger, or they just have a different understanding of the relationship between the citizen and state. So what does that mean in real terms? Immigrants tend to be, look at the way they vote. They vote for the Democratic Party because they tend to just view the state as more of a helper than your, I don't know, your typical American WASP or something.
Right.
Right. So your socially liberal immigration policies or your socially liberal transgender policies end up actually increasing the size of the state by some way or another. So it's just, it doesn't make any sense, and it's ultimately untenable. But I think the real issue for me is not that. It's that it's so hypocritical, at least in the sense that the elites use it, the chattering class,
yes,
the DC wonks and stuff like that. Like
they're lying.
Right, they're lying. And if they're not lying, then they're lying to themselves.
Maybe immigrants like Democrats because Democrats don't call them rapists.
Could be a part of it, yeah.
Like, you know, I... Maybe there's another reason.
Yeah, weird that people who might need help might vote for people who at least say that they want to help them.
Yeah, don't openly want to just kick them all out of the country.
And he talks at a different point in this interview about how allowing immigration isn't actually compassionate because immigrants tend to do poor, like, economically and academically than native-born people.
Gosh, I wonder if there's changes to tax policy and changes to education that we could make to help that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... But then this is where I think this conversation gets more interesting. Because Pedro Gonzalez is going to talk about how he doesn't consider himself aligned with either party because both of them are materialists.
All this raises the question, what kind of society should we be trying to create?
So I think both sides, left and right, tend to subordinate the things that are most important in life to materialism. And this is why I don't consider myself a capitalist or a socialist or a conservative or a liberal. Because I think both of these sides tend to view human as homo economicus. In other words, human happiness, the apogee of human happiness is some kind of materialism. We just need to provide you with more cheap televisions or something like that. Or
brightly colored plastic crap from China.
Right, exactly, yeah. Or a nice pod, a nice environmentally friendly pod. Like, that's happiness, right? I don't agree with that.
Have you ever talked to a human being, Pedro? Like, okay, in terms of human happiness as measured by, like, economic status, like, it's not because they're buying tat that people are happier if they have more money. It's because they can afford to pay their rent. Like, I don't...
Yeah, it, like... And I agree that sort of a shallow materialist, like, this item will make you happy is a product of capitalism.
Yeah.
Have
you, every advertisement ever, like, yeah. This product will make you sexy and happy and everything else you could ever possibly want.
And now we're living in an age where, like, corporations have hijacked the inner workings of our neurochemical... Like... That's all problematic.
Yeah, and, like, we have relationships with businesses with, like, edgy Twitter accounts and shit,
yeah.
And it's weird. It's very weird, and I don't like it.
Yeah, there are good...
I say we, I don't. I don't talk to Wendy's Twitter, I just look at Wendy's Twitter memes.
There are important conversations to be had about this stuff.
Yeah.
But that's not the conversation Pedro was trying to have. He is saying, like, these corporations are too woke, and it's infringing on my ability to be a bigot.
Yeah, and, like, he's just playing up this, like, enlightened centrism. Like, oh, I think both sides are stupid, so I'm a genius. No, it just makes you indecisive. And
and then this next clip is where my fascist alarm bell started going off.
All right, let's hear it.
a good example of what's possible is a country like Hungary. Hungary has recently decided that the most important thing for Hungary is not actually the GDP or some kind of economic output that we set for ourselves. It's actually the family, because the family is the one, the building block of society, and it's probably the only context in which people can really realize happiness in this kind of classical sense that we now would scoff at. The Greek term is eudaimonia, and what it means is not happiness in the sense of, like, you know, smoking pot or something like that,
right,
or going to a strip club. It means happiness in the sense of, like, life fulfilled to the fullest sense of its meaning. So, like, going from just starting off playing a piano to a perfect rendition of, like, the Moonlight Sonata. In this sense that you, in other words, you can't really quantify it. How do you quantify that kind of happiness? Or the value of, like, of a good father or of a good mother? You really can't put these things in economic terms. And I think, for me, that is actually the kind of society that I want to live in, where the most important thing is not getting as many women as possible into the workplace or making the GDP go as high as possible. It's allowing people to live happy lives, which are good lives, in this real sense of the word. Not this, you know, we use happiness all the time, it's very superficial. Like, what makes me happy is chemically castrating myself so that I can identify with the gender that I think, you know, I actually am. Like, that's not happiness. That's mental illness. And we enable it.
So I'd call it a false dichotomy, but it's more like a false quadricotomy. like, smoking pot, going to strip clubs, working if you're a woman, and being happy as a family, having good parents, being a good parent, can all coexist.
Yeah.
In one country, yeah, life, something, person.
Something I thought was telling there was enabling people to live happy lives, which are good lives. Good is doing a lot of work in that sentence for, like, what he thinks is good.
Yeah. Like, if you want this one specific thing to be your life, then this guy's ideas are great. But, like, if you want literally anything else, then...
Yeah, and what... And, like, we're not saying that everybody should be going to strip clubs and smoking pot. Like,
no.
But...
If you want to, you should be allowed to.
Yeah, who gives
who
a
cares?
Shit? But what got my alarm bells tripping there was when he held up Hungary as an example of, like, what we can aspire to.
Admittedly, I'm not super familiar with Hungary.
That's okay. But that's a problem. Not that you don't know, but that my sentence construction was a little poor there.
It's all good.
Him holding up Hungary as a beacon is a problem. Hungary... The most recent example in the news, and maybe what he's talking about when he says the family is the most important thing, is that they've recently enacted sweeping anti-LGBT laws. And specifically, like, framing them as anti-child abuse laws.
That sounds familiar.
But, like, you're not allowed to share content with children that depicts gay people. Like,
really?
Yeah, that's enshrined in law.
Wow, that's bad. That's real bad.
Yeah, and, like, Hungary's president, Viktor Orban, has, over the course of his reign, pretty systematically destroyed democratic safeguards and consolidated his power.
Wow.
I'll link some articles in the show notes about Hungary's descent into soft fascism.
Right, this is why I don't pay attention to world news, because it makes me sad. I'm sad enough over here, damn it.
Yeah, the fact that he's like a Viktor Orban stan is a problem.
Yeah.
But then they go on a bit of a tangent. Tucker Carlson asks, like, how did you get so smart? And Pedro talks about how he was in this program at this college he went to where they let you read primary sources. So, like, you were actually reading Marx instead of talking about what Marx said. Which I think,
okay.
I think is a, I don't think that's like an exclusive feature of his college. But,
yeah, no.
But then he's going to talk about his reaction to reading Marx. who has butt fucked Tyler on several occasions.
We didn't have to bring that up.
The first thing I said after reading some Marx was, he's actually right about a lot of the issues. Obviously, his communism is not the solution. The prescriptions are wrong. But his views of things like the disintegrating effects of capitalism, how it destroys the fabric of the family by reducing, by eliminating all distinctions between father and wife, parent and child, and just reducing everyone to basically units of production that are only distinguished by their value. Who can argue against that? And it's funny because we can get back on track. Conservatives actually kind of agree with Marx. They'll throw on slogans like, silly feminists, it was capitalism that crushed the patriarchy. Capitalism is what put more women than ever before in the workplace. It's like, do you hear what you're agreeing with Marx? You're saying that capitalism, that avarice, in other words, just unfettered greed, has totally made us lose sight of what's actually important, and we've destroyed the most important things in society just to make the line go up.
He's really hung up on women in the workforce.
Yeah.
In the beginning of this interview, he talked about how when he was a kid, he was ashamed of his parents' like socially conservative views. In particular, he says he was embarrassed of his dad, who had this very like patriarchal, the man is the head of the household view, and follows that up with, and of course now I realize he was right. It's like, no, you had it right before.
Yep.
And like, okay, to be fair, I do think a system where women have to work
is less ideal than a system in which they can work if they want.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that the less you're beholden to, like, the need to sell your labor, then that's generally a positive outcome. But that's not what he's talking about.
No.
This conversation here, all of them that we covered, with maybe the exception of Glenn Elmer's, have touched on this kind of, like, you know what it is? I keep catching myself almost saying that they're anti-capitalist. But what it is sort of like a soul-searching, like, oh, capitalism didn't make me happy after all.
Okay. I can see that.
Yes, it's like,
capitalism didn't hide the trans people, so obviously we have to...
Yeah.
We have to fix it so that... It hides the trans people.
Continuing that thread a bit, he calls Mitt Romney a eunuch.
Okay, I wasn't expecting that to hit me so hard, but...
Yeah, he's like, I'm not defending Mitt Romney. In fact, I think he's a total eunuch. But he introduced this bill I really liked. He talks about it's like the American Family Rescue Plan or something. That Romney introduced, I think I mentioned on this podcast that I wished Democrats would work with him to pass it, where it was like providing direct cash assistance to families with children. Yeah. And here Pedro Gonzalez is like, I actually liked that bill, because reading over it, I was like, this would make my wife and I more comfortable as we try to have her stay home and raise our child. And then from there, he segues into, he thinks... It's important that his wife stays home and makes all their kids meals, because food is going to make his kids' dick smaller.
What?
And
I was with you until.
I'm not positive how much of that explanation is in this clip, so I'll cover some ground just to be safe.
Okay, all right.
There was a story in the New York Times about these chemicals in food, and Tucker talked about it a bit in the context of them, like, reducing sperm counts, these, like, microplastics.
Oh, okay, yeah, I've heard this.
And another feature of that is that, like, it's been shown that consumption of these chemicals, it reduces the size of the taint, and on average, like, leads to smaller dick sizes.
Okay.
And so Pedro talks about how it's important that he's able to support his family on his income alone so that they don't have to feed their child that crap, which... is laudable.
Yeah.
But the way they talk about this goes kind of off the rails.
Wait a second. If the entire population is feeding their children food that shrinks the size of their genitals and disrupts their endocrine system, destroys them physically and maybe mentally too, poisoning their kids, why isn't anyone... I mean, you're 30, you live in rural Ohio. Why are you the first person who said this to me this week?
Because it's not fashionable if you're on the right, if you're a conservative, to talk about this, right? Because we're supposed to be the deregulation camp. We're supposed to cut regulations on food, not regulate heavy metals out of food. We're supposed to turn a blind eye to it and say, well, that's the market.
So we're the movement that's totally cool with heavy metals in the food, falling sperm count, crashing testosterone
because
levels.
Because if we regulate food and, you know, because of that, all the things you just enumerated, if we regulate food, well, then the cost of it might go up. And, you know, God forbid people might have to pay like an extra dollar for food that won't kill them or give them cancer.
But you don't even need to jump to federal regulation, maybe just saying so out loud.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, I, because it's associated, again, with a kind of liberalism.
Okay, Mr. Tucker Fox News. destroy their genitals and poison them is an overstatement for what's happening.
Yeah.
I agree. It would be good if we had fewer microplastics in our food. That'd be good. We should reduce that.
Yeah, like this is a problem. I don't know if I can even identify exactly what it is about that conversation that sits so wrong with me.
I don't like the idea that he said something like, "Oh, God forbid people have to pay more for food." People are fucking poor.
Yeah. Like,
paying an extra dollar for every meal or whatever is a burden on a lot of people. Yeah,
and,
so,
and there is food available that is less harmful. People can't afford it.
Yeah.
So then Tucker, he's going to ask Pedro how he feels about the term Latinx.
I want to give you, there are a million examples of this, but I want to give you one. The phrase Latinx, I'm not even sure that I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's a term that white liberals have tried to impose on the Latino community.
Yeah.
What is that? Where does that come from? What's the point of using a non-gendered term like Latinx on a gendered language?
I will only accept it if it's used to refer to me as a Latin extremist. I'm just kidding. No. basically, it's this attempt to... this is how I see it. It's an attempt to homogenize and emasculate the good things in Latino culture, which is this kind of machismo, this atavism that I think is actually really healthy because we don't have any of it in American society. And in a way, it's basically an attempt to strip all of these things that, like you said, white liberals find problematic about Latin culture and just turn it into this androgynous, sterilized thing that is indistinguishable and actually perfectly indistinguishable from white liberal culture. And I think just as importantly, it's perfect for consumerism. Because we all, like Latinx people and like black people that also subscribe to these things and white people and Asians, everyone who, regardless of how you look and your background, everyone who subscribes to this culture ultimately has the same tastes, opinions, and worldviews. And it makes it really great to have a huge consumer base like that because you're all saying the same things. You're all shopping at the same place. You all think.
Therefore, you're all willing to buy AirPods.
Right. Yeah, and live in a pod and eat bugs because you all agree that that's good. That is the way to live, right? Don't own anything, don't have kids, pronouns. You all agree, regardless if you're Latinx or black or white, like you've all been homogenized, but we call this diversity.
So really, you're not you're describing the opposite of diversity.
Yeah.
You're describing a homogenized culture that's homogenized by corporate forces.
Yep, that's right.
Are we really going to make this into an issue? Okay. I lost track of all of the stupid things they said. Usually they're so quick to jump on the transphobia, so I'm surprised they didn't this time.
Yeah.
And he kind of answered his own question before we listened to all of that. What is the point of using a gender-neutral word so that you can include people who are not male or female.
Yeah.
Wow, that was hard. It doesn't have anything to do with homogenizing the culture, whatever the fuck that means.
And what he was talking about there is, like, stripping away Latin identity and flattening them all into a homogenized consumer base that you can sell the same things to. I don't know what to do with that.
I don't either. Like, I don't think that anyone thought about this any more than, oh, Latinx probably saves characters on tweets.
And, like, if... Okay. If we divorce this from the Latinx, which maybe it's wrong to divorce that because that's the question he was answering, but the phenomena of trying to erase cultural differences to flatten everyone into a consumer base that the same products can be marketed to. I don't know. That feels like something that I would believe.
Yeah, like, I don't... Okay, I think they are trying to pretend that, like, this is just some corporate wokeness or something, and they're trying to, like, change the culture. Generally, when corporations co-opt, that's not the right word, when corporations, like, steal liberal language, it's usually pretty cringe.
Yeah.
Honestly, and doesn't do anything to help people. Like, it's Pride Month. The beginning of Pride Month, everyone, like, changed their logos to rainbow flags or whatever. And, like, Google doesn't give a shit about gay rights. Like, Apple doesn't give a shit about gay... They're not doing anything to help gay people. They're just like, oh, we care about you. Please give us more money and buy our products.
Yeah. And you just resolved the tension I was having. Because I think the issue I was running into is that, like... I think, in general, a problem that they're alluding to exists, yeah. But I don't believe them. And you... And that's what it is. It's that they wouldn't be talking about this if corporations had, quote-unquote, gone woke.
Yeah.
Like, this never would have been a problem if it weren't about inclusion.
Yeah. Glad to be helpful.
And then Tucker is a bad interviewer. Like, listen to this shit.
This is an anecdote, but in the places where you didn't have rioting... during Black Lives, the wave of riots last year, it was Hispanic communities, Latino communities. Why do you think that is? Because they protect their communities. They don't, like, they're not going to sit back and watch looters, you know, like, tear through their neighborhoods and stuff. And of course, what I just said would make some white liberal or Latinx person, like, clutch their pearls. But that's good. That, because that...
Wait, but you're saying they're not intersectional, actually.
What do you mean?
Just throwing the world's dumbest term around.
Yeah, it immediately made my brain shut down. Right.
Sorry. You just blacked out for a second when I used the word.
Yeah.
So, Pedro Gonzalez provided an independent thought there, and rather than follow up, Tucker just said a word he didn't know the definition of. And then everybody got confused.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what they say. It's all just a joke. It feels like well-trodden ground, but referring to BLM as looters.
Yeah,
stop it. You're stupid.
This might be a good time. I want to read a couple of excerpts from an article that Pedro Gonzalez wrote called "Reckoning with the Aftermath of George Floyd."
All right.
The 72 hours that followed George Floyd's death on Monday, May 25th, saw Minneapolis plunge into a shocking disorder. Rioters reduced to ash Midtown Corner, a $30 million six-story rental complex with 189 apartments for low-income renters, including more than three dozen units for very low-income tenants. Looters pillaged businesses big and small, with the latter already struggling due to COVID-19 lockdowns. And then he continues on for several paragraphs describing other buildings that were destroyed. And then brings it to this point. On the right, the architects of the Trump White House's soft-on-crime policies and positions are celebrities of MAGA Inc. Brooke Rollins is the president and CEO of a hilariously named America First Policy Institute, where Jerron Smith is chairman of the Center for Second Chances, carrying on the good work of letting bad people out from behind bars. As an institution, the GOP is more or less on board with the basic narrative of systemic racism, choosing the likes of Senator Tim Scott as its figurehead. The reckoning has yet to materialize. It's not the one that the rioters want, however, but the one that is a pathologically soft and tender America needs. So his argument, after cherry-picking all of these stories of buildings destroyed by rioters, is that the Trump administration was too soft on crime.
Interesting take.
Which I think it's important that that's his framework as they talk more about BLM going forward. He wants some, like, the tear gas, the people loaded up in vans. None of that was enough.
And, like,
actually, thank God.
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I know that George Floyd's death was, like, a long time ago, and people are probably sick of talking about it, but, like, kneeling on a guy's neck for 8 minutes straight, like, more should have changed, man.
For real.
It should have been a bigger deal.
Actually, thank God that maybe Latinos have not completely assimilated, especially men, because then they would be emasculated. It's a kind of, like, spiritual castration, in my view. Actually, I don't think that's my view. I think that's actually what is happening. Like, you're literally castrating men. But
if you want to preserve a society, why would you castrate its defenders?
Because you don't want to preserve it.
Yeah. Thank you for noting the obvious, Mr. Yes. Gonzalez.
Right. Yeah. This is what professional intellectual here. Now, no, I think that's right. A people who are emasculated are just much easier to manage. And it's not just easier to govern them, because I think that's something that's familiar with conservatives, but also it's much easier to market to them.
Yes.
And it's much easier to get them to live a way of life where, again, the most important aspects of life are stigmatized, and I think the basest aspects of life, those are elevated. The climbing the corporate ladder, just making more money, not having a family because it's too inconvenient, things like that.
Okay, again, has he talked to a human person recently?
Yeah.
I know there's, like, the people climbing the corporate ladder in every movie ever, but I don't know a lot of real people who actually do that.
Yeah, the handful of people I've met who their life is about climbing the corporate ladder are not generally well-liked.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the prevailing cultural moray.
No.
I mean, I am just shook, though, Tyler, that our defenders have all been castrated.
Yeah, that's a real problem if it actually happened.
He's really into this idea of, like, strong men and, like, masculinity.
Yeah, he was talking about that in the Latinx section. Like,
yeah, it's a through line. At the beginning, when he's talking about his ideological journey, he says that he came to be disgusted with weakness masquerading as virtue. Implying there that, you know, strong men are
virtuous.
Are what we should be striving for, you know.
Okay.
I don't think that strong man has any connotation in the world of politics.
No, surely not.
Actually, thank God that maybe Latinos have not completely...
Oops. Okay, so in this next clip, Tucker's going to play a clip from a time Pedro appeared on his show. They're talking about the Republican Party and how voters should think about them.
You've come on our nighttime show on Fox News several times, and I think enhanced it.
Thank you.
You came on last month and made a point that really stuck with me, and you described the Republican Party as an instrument of the will of Republican voters. So let's play the clip for those who didn't see it.
I think that Republican voters need to stop viewing the party as an ally and start viewing it as an instrument, something to be whipped into shape and not relied upon, because there is no plan but what we make. The Republican Party is an instrument to be willed, not something to rely on, because they're going to stab you in the back.
So you repeated that line because I asked you to repeat that line.
Glad you did.
Because I love that line, and I've been thinking about it ever since. Republicans need to understand their party is an instrument that must be bent to their will. They don't conform to the leadership.
That's right.
The leaders of the party follow their voters.
Yep. That's right.
What, I mean, that's what democracy is it not?
What a concept, right? Yeah, George W. Bush comes out of wherever he's been hiding to tell us that we need to be more compassionate about immigration and things like that, you're right. The proper reflex to that is go away or shut up. And that's actually how we should be thinking of politicians. It's like, you're not giving me an opinion. I put you in office. I gave you power. And you're going to do what myself and my community, the Republican base at large, like, you're there because we put you there to do what we want.
Okay, a couple of things there. Most recently, the proper reflex to compassion is shut up and go away. You sound like a delight to be around, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, and then, is there more about the, before I talk about it too much, is there more about, like, Republican leaders have to realize that they're beholden to their voters?
Not really, no.
Okay, so, like, you can say that all you want, but that's not the way it works right now.
Yeah.
Like, they're beholden to lobbyists. Like, they get voted for, obviously, but they don't give a shit what their voters say if someone's paying them enough.
Yeah, and this...
Unless you're proposing to change that somehow, yeah, and Mr. Gonzalez.
I haven't seen him address lobbying specifically, but I think he would want to get rid of that. But what... this is, again, I don't... I think that that politicians delivering on the promises made to their constituents is generally a good thing.
Yeah.
I just don't want them to fulfill what Pedro wants them to do.
Yeah, I think I'm probably in the same boat.
But there's a spiritual rot in our country, Tyler.
What concerns me is that the humiliation levels have risen to just really an unprecedented place. Yeah. You know, so people who have thoughts that diverge from those of Tim Cook or Susan Rice really are under attack for real. Get fired, whatever. And people seem to put up with it, and that makes me wonder about people's dignity. I mean, if you have dignity, if you're a man, why would you allow yourself to be treated like that?
There is a real kind of spiritual rot in the country, and it's not relegated to left. I think it's also on the right. You have people like David French, Frank Luntz, people that just have no sense of dignity. And I've characterized it as a kind of psychosexual ethnomasochism, where it's like, it's not just that you don't have any dignity. It seems to be that you actually kind of enjoy the shame. It makes you feel good to flog yourself. And I think you saw this really come out during the rioting last year, where you had not just liberals, but also Republican politicians and conservative pundits just kowtowing to Black Lives Matter. America's bad. America was born in original sin. We need to make it better. Marco Rubio talking about systemic inequality, and Tim Scott referring to America's history as original sin. I think her name is Linda Thomas Green, the ambassador to the UN.
Yes.
She said the same thing. America's history as original sin. What is the fundamental difference between the way conservative men and like liberals, or I should say pundits and Republican lawmakers, what is the fundamental difference between them, between conservatives and liberals? I don't see it. But to the point about men, it really does seem to be the case that they enjoy it. They enjoy the self-flagellation.
psychosexual ethnomasochism. If there's any phrase I would like to credit you for introducing into the common lexicon is that. So speaking of psychosexual ethnomasochism, a phrase I've never heard before but will never forget, we have a clip of America's foremost psychosexual ethnomasochist, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, right after the BLM riots.
Okay. What? What was all that? I am so lost.
Yeah,
it's psychosexual ethnomasochism.
Yeah, that was a wild.
What does that have anything to do with what he was talking about after that?
The reason that men don't feel humiliated when they're told that, I guess, racism exists is like that they don't stand up against that because they enjoy the humiliation.
Okay, I mean, if you're into humiliation, that's fine. Whatever.
Like, it's his masculinity thing, and, like, his diagnosis of the problem is that you're too much of a bitch.
yeah. That was a joke. I don't think that, that conservatives are actually into that. I don't know what he's talking about. Republican is coming out and then saying things that people, like their constituents or like the Republican Party, doesn't like? They don't do that.
Yeah, the examples he gives, like he's mad at Tim Scott for saying that systemic racism exists.
He was just talking about people who are refusing to deny history. Okay, I'm getting into his craziness, and I hate how boringly crazy he is.
I know. I found him very hard to disentangle. Like, even in these clips, there are things I don't know how to refute because, like, the basis is so alien.
Yeah, yeah, I'm feeling it, too. I completely understand.
Tucker plays a clip of Mitt Romney supporting Black Lives Matter, which makes him the chief psychosexual ethnomasochist. And then, so, one thing that Pedro and I do have in common is that neither of us like Ben Shapiro.
All right, cool. You know, you gotta take what you can get.
Like, he wrote a whole article that was kind of like throwing shade on Shapiro. He never mentions my name, but the title was The Failure of Facts and Logic. And then
that seems pretty.
And he talks about how conservatives waste their time. Instead of actually coming up with ideas, they waste their time coming up with catchy slogans about facts and feelings.
Okay.
So that this clip I labeled Facts and Logic here, because that page is going to talk about why the left can't be reasoned with.
There you have Mitt Romney marching along with the crowd, unthinkingly repeating their slogans.
Yep.
Totally unwilling to note that all lives matter, which, by the way, they do. But he seems so pleased. Is that the kind of masochism that you're talking about?
Well, Mike Braun, who came on your show and was like, yeah, I support Black Lives Matter. I think he donated to them, right?
Yeah,
like that. Like, I literally can't understand it. Maybe it sounds like irrational, the kind of anger that I feel when I hear people say that. But maybe actually we should be a little bit less understanding of that kind of thing. Where is your dignity? Where is your pride? I don't know. Like, these things really quickly stray into... I've been called illogical sometimes for talking like this. My response is, logic, where's your thumos? Where's your spiritedness? Where's your defense of your country and your family? More importantly, I think, family, right? Because that's what everything is founded on. So when there are people who are just doing whatever they want, burning, looting, pillaging cities, and your only response is to roll over and show them your belly, I literally can't understand that.
What the fuck are you on about, dude?
Yeah. Like, so he wants strong, masculine men running the state and not putting up with disagreement. Is, I think, if you disentangle all of his webs of bullshit...
God, I just, it's so, yeah, he's, ugh.
Yeah,
Chris just watching me have an existential crisis over here. I'm trying not to interrupt the clip, and I'm just like, ah.
Your face was a journey during that. I think this would be a good time for me to read a bit from another of his articles called The Revolutionary Road. The tagline of this article is, "The emerging post-right must disabuse itself of tolerance as a principle, as the left has, if it intends to do more than lose with grace."
The left has disassociated with tolerance. That's his position?
Yes.
Okay, so he has no basis in reality, just from the get-go, is my...
Yeah, so he talks here about... okay, quote, "The basic narrative of this story is familiar to most people on the right. The left took over the institutions that create taste, thought, and opinion. Some of those same institutions, like academia, also train award credentials to the elites who go on to influence other institutions, like media, industry, and government. Nevertheless, some on the right insist that culture is downstream in politics. Legislation changes culture. It's certainly true that laws can habituate us to live a certain way. This forms the basis of the Aristotelian view of ethical development, in which laws inculcate virtue or unleash vice. In this sense, they are on better footing than their counterparts, who insist it is either impossible or undesirable to, quote, legislate morality. But take, for example, the legislative efforts to ban critical race theory. The basic narrative of critical race theory, about American original sin and white guilt, already pervades every tissue and organ of American life. Journalist Christopher Rufo recently revealed that cultural titan Walt Disney Corporation claims that America was founded on systemic racism, encourages employees to complete a white privilege checklist, and separates minorities into racially segregated affinity groups. The political skirmishes against critical race theory are noble and laudable, but ultimately they will be swallowed up in the cultural gullet of the regime unless a different grand strategy comes into view. Therefore, there is the possibility of using political power to change cultural institutions. But where the right must grow now requires abandoning preconceived principles and rules of engagement, leaving its old self behind to fight a new kind of war, more akin to Leninism than the senescent Republican ideology that cannot, under its own limited government terms, enter the foray properly."
Okay. This feels like such foundational stuff, but to deny that America was founded in racism is to deny history. And yeah. how do you engage with that? You can't. Like, you just have such a... You have nothing to stand on after that. And he's on Tucker's show.
Yeah, it's fucking wild, dude. Like, the conservatives need to be more Leninist in their approach. where was the one I wanted? "Rather than dismantling the National Endowment for Humanities, which supports research, education, preservation, and public programs in the humanities, the post-right should aim to take control of the institution, to conduct a cultural hegemony supportive of its political ends. Abolishing tax exemptions, subsidies, and federal contracts for academic and professional institutions that provide the ideological lifeblood of the prevailing cultural hegemony is an imperative and practical step. A precondition of all this is distinguishing between friend and enemy, something that we so far seem incapable of doing properly, in part because the right has deluded itself with, quote, big tent thinking. A recent study found political appointees in the Trump administration were only about 50% Republican, compared to more than 80% Democratic appointees under Presidents Clinton and Obama. The post-right must disabuse itself of tolerance as a principle, as the left has, if it intends to do more than lose the grace and grit. Thus, the real division is not over which way the river of power really flows, but between reformists and revolutionaries, those who want to merely take over cocktail parties and those who want to assault, discredit, and replace the culture and the ruling class and the regime it sustains."
So he wants to replace academic study with propaganda factories, is what he wants.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the shit that he is professing that he wants to do here is scary.
Yeah.
I mean, He wrote a different article. I think I talked about this, but he wrote an article about how we should nationalize social media companies. And
nationalize social media companies.
Yeah, and make them like a public utility provided by the government. Because then, like, you can... Because corporations do have the right to control what content is on their platforms, right? So then if you nationalize them, you can do away with that censorship.
Okay.
Which, I don't know what the... Oh, he also talks about how you can use the tax revenue from the government running Facebook to reduce the... Or not even the revenue, like the operating revenue. Because in his conception, Facebook would still be making money. And the proceeds from that could be used to lower the tax burden on the middle class.
Why are there so many steps in between make Facebook pay taxes? Like,
right?
Why does the government have to take over Facebook?
Yeah, what does this even look like? Do they just buy out Zuckerberg? What?
Yeah, and like, okay, there are a lot of reasons that the government doesn't have its own, like, journal. There's a reason that independent people go and assess what the government says, because if you get someone in power who doesn't want the truth out anymore, then they can just change their journalism to, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like he's not even really getting around the censorship thing this way.
Yeah, it's super fucked up, man.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And he's on Tucker Carlson.
And I don't think Tucker fully even understands the ideas he's engaging with, honestly, in this conversation.
How can you? He's so fucking boring.
Because, like, at this point, Pedro is bringing some ideas to the fore, right? And Tucker responds by telling him about a Black Lives Matter sign that he drove past.
I drove by a house this morning with my dogs on the way to go fish. And it was this tidy little rural farmhouse, beautiful little house. And there was a... And it looks like a tidy little family inside, I'm sure, I happen to know. And there was a Black Lives Matter sign out front. And I remember thinking, you know, on one level, I'm sure they're good-hearted people, right, who think that Black Lives Matter, as every normal, decent person does. Of course, Black Lives Matter. All lives matter, right? So I get that on that level. But it's been there for almost a year, and you think Black Lives Matter, as in its platform, calls for the destruction of the nuclear family. So why wouldn't that be a deal killer for a nuclear family?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
How could that support that?
Yeah. No, and I think the this is another problem that I think we run into, is we try to confront these things with facts and logic.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. This is an ideology. It borders on a kind of religious belief.
Yes.
I really think a lot of aspects of modern or advanced liberalism really are a kind of religion. And so when people say, like, well, religion is on decline in America, my response is, no, it's not. It's just a different kind of religion, in my view. And you had people kneeling and praying for forgiveness during Black Lives Matter riots. I don't know if you remember this, but you had church...
Like it was yesterday.
Yeah. Church congregations praying to BLM organizers, begging them for forgiveness. There was a video that was circulated online of people carrying a shrine. It was a black fist carrying a shrine to a clip from some movie. I'm going to butcher this part, but the point is that you basically had people carrying a shrine with religious overtones. It was like a religious procession. And again, they're asking for forgiveness for BLM. And I don't. How do you confront that with facts and logic? You can't. I think the best thing you can do is just grab somebody, maybe not literally, unless you know them really well, and just shake them away. Like, what is wrong with you? You're completely surrendering your civilization and your dignity, and more importantly, posterity. Like, future generations will be worse off because you're a coward. Wake up.
Okay, so a couple of things. The through line that I'm picking up on is, like, ever admitting that you've made a mistake is bad.
Yeah, it's weakness. You're surrendering your dignity.
Yeah, and so, and then... smaller, but, like, he's also just like, oh, these people don't believe the same thing as me, so they're religious.
Yeah.
I whatever.
If you support BLM, you're surrendering your civilization and your dignity.
Yeah, like, I don't understand. I mean, I guess if you are a person who legitimately believes that you should never apologize for anything ever, then I get why you wouldn't support BLM, because there's no reason to apologize to black people for the centuries of slavery. Yeah. And then I meant to touch on this earlier. I don't know. I probably don't have to do this for our audience, because our audience is smart. The reason All Lives Matter is stupid is it completely ignores context. The example that I liked was, if you're at dinner and your dad gets up and passes out food to everyone except you, and then you say, "But my meal matters," and he looks at you and says, "All of our meals matter, son," you'd be pretty pissed off.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I can't believe he actually... I can't believe Tucker actually identifies as, like, an All Lives Matter
person. I know. It's,
person. It's so cringe.
It's pathetic.
Yeah.
And, like, I say that I don't think Tucker understands the ideas he's engaging with. I don't mean that just to insult him. I mean that literally. I don't think that Tucker is on the same level here. He's just, like, the slogan, All Lives Matter, and Pedro was, like, weakness will destroy our civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I cannot like overstate how scary this person is. I don't like that he is getting a platform.
I'm glad that you hear it too. I thought I might have been crazy.
No, but like it,
And I also remembered a point I wanted to make earlier when they were talking about the Republican Party being an instrument that you have to whip into shape. That is a good through line to it. We've talked a lot about, like, Tucker attacking or platforming different Republicans based on whether or not they fit what he wants them to do. And so the kind of the point of exploring these interviews was looking at what exactly is the program? What is, like, the, I guess you could say, post-right that Tucker is trying to influence
create,
on the world.
Yeah.
And if it's this, I don't like.
Nope. Nope. It's real bad.
So we have we're almost to the end here. Tucker asks Pedro Gonzalez if what we're seeing today has ever happened before.
All right.
Future generations will be worse off because you're a coward. We need to tattoo that on people. have we seen this before? Is this part of a recognizable progression of a civilization?
No, I think civilizations decline and fall. You have Polybius, Machiavelli. This is a theme, right? The cycle of civilizations. But I think what's new is that, and there's a political theorist named Samuel P. Huntington. He was a Harvard professor.
Yes.
And he noted this, I think, in 2005, that never before has the ruling class of a civilization deliberately, knowingly dismantled it. Like, this is just, you really can't find an example of this. You can find examples of like, negligent ruling classes.
Right, of course.
Like, late Rome or something.
Of course.
But the idea of, like, the ruling class saying, yeah, we actually hate our ancestors, we hate our history, and this all needs to go. We need to fundamentally change the society that we inherited. You can't find a precedent for it. And I don't have an explanation for it. It truly is a phenomenon that does not get enough attention. Because it seems pretty important that the American overclass is inculcating these views in everyday people that, by the way, they really don't suffer the consequences for them. Like, their communities don't change. Nancy Pelosi's community doesn't change.
That's right.
Mine does. Hers doesn't. But again, this has never happened before. We've said, like, actually the family's bad. Or, you know, actually Christianity is bad. Unless it's consistent with, like, the tenets of BLM or something. There's not really any precedent. We really are in uncharted waters. And again, I don't understand why this is not more hotly debated. It's kind of, again, maybe it's connected to the loss of dignity that we just kind of shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's progress, man. We here's another good example. There's a drug called medroxyprogesterone acetate, and for decades we've used it to chemically castrate sex offenders. Now, it is commonly used in gender affirmation therapy. So, we used to chemically castrate sex offenders, now we chemically castrate children, and we just shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's progress.
Why do we have to do the chemical castration thing so often?
I know, every fucking time.
Seriously, oh my god. Okay, that was the fun part. I feel like he's mixing up his definitions here. The ruling class has never... What did he say? Has never...
Like, it's never intentionally dismantled the society it rules over.
Okay. So, I consider the ruling class billionaires, not politicians, first of all.
Yeah, and they really want to preserve the society that made them billionaires.
Yep, they sure do. And I don't think they actually care. But, like, the idea that no civilization... I don't have an example, but the idea that no civilization has ever had, like, a dramatic change in opinion about a topic sounds absolutely impossible, given the long history of humanity.
Yeah, like, we were talking about the Iranian Revolution earlier. A big part of the reason that, like, the militant religious faction supported the revolution, it was because of... the Shah trying to, like, westernize Iran and bring in a lot of, like, Western cultural influence. So, which I guess I don't think is dismantling a society, but by Pedro's definition it would be, right? So.
Yeah, yeah. And like, acknowledging your history is dismantling the society?
Yeah.
How?
I guess dismantling white supremacy at...
It's not even doing that, because people like you still exist that are like, no, racism was fine, actually.
Yeah, and
slavery was fine, actually.
And now that I'm getting in my bearings a bit, when I say I believe Pedro Gonzalez to be a fascist, he cribs the language of fascism real hard. Like, it's all about strength. It's about dominance and... like, not sacrificing your dignity.
Right, and, yeah.
Like, that's how you get behind a straw man.
Yeah.
And, I'm sorry, a strong man. The opposite of a straw man, maybe.
Yeah, right.
And then that combined with his program of, like, again, wanting to nationalize means of mass communication under a government that will prevent conservatives from being censored.
Yeah.
Like, it... There's one more clip. Well, technically two more, but the last one's super short. But in this next one, Tucker plays the video of his Asa Hutchinson interview again to make a point about, I don't know, like, Republican leaders not being sufficiently bigoted.
Right.
And then...
giving into the woke agenda.
And it was kind of funny, because, like, he plays this video, but then Pedro didn't have an earpiece in, so he didn't hear any of it. But Tucker summarizes it for him, and then Pedro goes on a 3-minute transphobic tirade.
Oh, no.
The torment, I don't know if you heard that on an earpiece, but basically, as Hutchinson was explaining, that Ronald Reagan would have wanted kids to be sexually castrated. That was one of the planks in his platform, as you remember from 1980.
Yes. Vividly.
But really, small government.
From 1980, when all those condom zealots were trying to keep people from touching each other.
And Ronald Reagan, shut up.
Yeah, yeah.
What should an effective Republican conservative leader say in the face of an attempt to normalize the mutilation of children?
Well, I think that, and I don't want to denigrate people that are on the local and state level trying to fight the spread of transgender ideology. And I think the most identifiable thing is the trans sports bills. But I think that even there, we start from the wrong position. The argument is not that there's something fundamentally wrong with this, it's that we want our sports, bread and circuses, I mean sports, to be free of biologically unfair competition. You see what's wrong with that?
That's a smart point.
You've
already ceded the only ground that matters.
Yeah. It's fine if Jazz Jennings wants to take puberty blockers from such an early age that his male genitals are so small by the time he wants to transition. This is a teen trans star. So small by the time he wants to transition that they actually had to use stomach lining.
I just want to say here, Jazz Jennings, if you're not familiar, is a young kind of Instagram famous trans person.
Oh, okay.
And Pedro consistently misgenders her.
Why does that not surprise me?
To construct female genitalia for him. That's fine, as long as the government stays out of it and he doesn't play in girls' sports. Like, you've already lost. You have already fundamentally lost that argument. And so my view is, because right now you have the whole gender candidacy in California, my view is this. You shouldn't be cruel to these people, but you also shouldn't enable them. Like, I think this is accurately characterized as a mental illness. And in other words, we need therapy, not normalization, and certainly not glorification. Like, we shouldn't say, like, actually trans rights, that is a conservative issue, which is what National Review has actually published. They have published more than one article arguing that trans rights is a conservative issue. Which is why I consider myself a conservative anymore.
Well, wouldn't you more accurately not consider National Review conservative anymore?
Yeah, I mean,
whatever, therefore, you're not,
yeah,
on that team.
Yeah, right. I mean, they want to conserve corporate tax cuts, but not biological sexes. So I think that's the position, is, look, we don't want anyone to be abused or shouted at for experiencing what was until recently considered gender dysphoria. We want these people to get treated, and we want them to get the care they need. And I think here's the important part. I think the Jenner candidacy is a really good example of this. So people have pointed out to me, well, look, Jenner had 6 kids. So what's the big deal? It's like, great for him. But younger and younger people are starting to identify as trans at the same time that we're pushing the therapy, transition, which is a euphemism, right? Transition therapy on kids more than ever before, because that's actually great for Big Pharma. They're making billions of dollars selling these drugs that for the transition.
That's an exaggeration. It's not prevalent enough for it to be that lucrative.
So at the same time that more and more kids are starting to experience gender dysphoria, we're also making it easier for them to get access. We want to make it easier for them to get access to the transition therapy. In other words, they're not going to get the chance to father 6 kids like Jenner did. Like, they're not going to get that chance to start a family. But it's fine as long as the government stays out of it.
So that argument that, sure, Jenner had 6 kids, but if we allow young people to get treatment,
to transition,
yeah, then they're not going to get to. Yeah, that's fucking the idea. Like, I guess not. You know what I mean? Okay,
being trans doesn't preclude you from having a family.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
They call it castration, but it's not.
That's
so
a much better
you.
Version of what I was trying to say.
That's okay. This has been a rough one, Troy. I think I've developed something of a concluding statement. If we have one more clip, right?
I'll play that and then you can go.
Okay.
This is just Tucker closing out the conversation. He says something that sent a chill down my spine.
Oh, boy.
Pedro Gonzalez, 30 years old. I have a feeling you're going to be around for a long time, influencing the way the country thinks. I certainly hope so. And I wanted to get it on tape at the beginning.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Tucker.
Well, I certainly hope he's wrong. So, okay, I feel bad. I feel a little bit like I've let down the audience by having such a hard time getting past this guy. Like, I'm very scared that conservatives are going to be more like this in the future.
Yeah.
Just, like, really nice-sounding evil people. So, on one hand, it's really scary to me that they have to, that they're gonna start sounding more like this. But on the other hand, almost all of his arguments are predicated on made up villains. Yeah. Like, I'm against people castrating our children, which isn't happening. I'm against the abolition of the nuclear family, which isn't happening.
Yeah.
I'm against, you know, so I, this tells me that conservatives are on the back foot and things are changing in our favor, actually. And that's the happiest thing I can pull out of this experience today, because listening to him talk about things hurts me.
Yeah, it
so much.
You put it well, having a hard time getting past him. I had the same feeling. At the end of our last episode, Jordan Peterson said, like, the best story always wins, and I said that I think the left needs a better story to counter what these people are, like, developing right now, which is this, like, the preservation of the family type thing.
Yeah.
We need, like, I have a feeling that with Tucker's platform and everything, and just his way of slipping past defenses, I think that we're going to hear a lot more people talking like Pedro Gonzalez.
Which sucks.
And this is kind of a good training exercise, because I think we're pretty smart people, and we had a hard time with him.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So we're going to need to get better at...
Please don't listen to the previous episode where we said we hadn't graduated college. To be fair, we both have associate's degrees, but that's not a marker.
Yeah, I have an associate's degree that I'm actively hostile to the idea of ever using.
And I have one that's completely vague and useless.
But, we've got to get better at dealing with the Pedro Gonzalez's that are coming, because... it's important, like, I just want to point out again, what he wants is for America to look more like Hungary.
Yeah. He wants the existence of sexual minorities to be abolished, and that's bad for a lot of people. Arguably bad for everyone, that there's anyone in their society that isn't allowed to exist.
Yeah, so I suspect that we'll talk about Pedro Gonzalez again, but for now, this is the end of him.
Thank God. Okay.
And we... Oh, you know how I said this was going to be a shorter episode?
Did we break a record?
No, it's 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Okay.
And like, when I cut out the gaps, it always shaves a minute or two off. Thank you so much to anyone who sat through us being bewildered by a fascist.
Yep.
We'll be back with an episode breaking down the nightly show on Monday, kind of going back to our bread and butter.
If you've joined the Patreon in the last, like, 2 days, we're going to thank you on the next Monday episode, because
yes,
we fear that this episode might not get as much listens.
Yeah, I suspect this one will have less listenership, which is okay.
Yeah.
But hey, prove me wrong, fellas. In the
meantime, and ladies.
Yes.
I don't know if fellas is a gender term exactly, but...
And Latinx people and whoever is listening. In the meantime, we've got a website, tuckitoutpod.com. You can find us on Twitter at tuckitoutpod. We're on Patreon. Yeah.
We have a website?
I think I said that.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Dude, it's been a long day.
we'll be back. We'll see you guys then. In the meantime, try to enjoy your life and make sweet, sweet love to Karl Marx.
Thank you for listening.
Buck up. It's going to get better.